our third topic on today's agenda. The technical topic is rate regulated activities. And with that, let me pass over to Omar. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Good morning, good afternoon to all of you, depending on wherever you are based. Thank you all for joining us today. As you may know, the board published the ED regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities back in January. In today's session, we will present a high-level summary of the main features of the ED to gather your initial feedback on the board's proposals. We will run this session as follows. First, I will introduce you to the proposals on scope, what are regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities, and their measurement. Then, we will look at presentation, disclosure, and transition proposals for which we have specific questions for you that I will ask after presenting each of the respective sections. In the interest of time, we will not go through all the slides in detail. However, if you would like to discuss any aspects of the proposals at a deeper level, we would be more than happy to schedule a meeting to go through them offline. Let's start with slide 5. The scope of the ED is targeted to the accounting for regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities, which is only a subset of the rights and obligations that are created by a regulatory agreement. Regulatory agreements that are capable of creating those assets and liabilities are expected to be found in utilities such as gas, water, and electricity, as well as public transportation such as toll roads, air traffic control, and airport services. To be within the scope of the ED, the regulatory agreements need to be enforceable and determine the regulated rates to be charged to customers in a way that gives rise to differences in timing, which we will discuss shortly. Those differences in timing create regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. Let's move to slide 6 and look more closely to differences in timing. The ED would apply to rate regulation that establishes how much compensation the company is entitled to charge customers for the goods or services supplied, and when, that is in which period, that compensation can be included in the rates charged. Typically, the compensation for goods or services supplied is charged to customers through the rates for the period in which a company supplies those goods or services. However, in some cases, there is a difference in timing. The regulatory agreement determines the regulated rate in such a way that part of the compensation for goods or services supplied in a period is charged to customers in a previous period or will be charged to customers in a future period. When this happens, the amount of revenue the company recognizes in a period applying IFRS 15 first includes compensation for goods or services supplied in the past or that will be supplied in the future, or second, does not include all the compensation that the company is entitled for the goods or services supplied in the period because part of this compensation was already included in rates charged in the past or will be included in rates to be charged in the future. To bring this problem to life, we illustrate the problem on slide 7. Without information about the difference in timing of CU20, investors would not understand that revenue in year 1 does not include compensation of CU20 for goods supplied in that year, and revenue in year 2 includes compensation of CU20 that relates to goods supplied in year 1. Moving now to slide 8. So without information about differences in timing caused by rate regulation, it is difficult for investors to understand completely the relationship between a company's revenue and its expenses. Ultimately, that makes it difficult for investors to assess the company's prospects for future cash flows. So the proposals aim to inform investors about how differences in timing caused by rate regulation affect companies' financial performance and financial position. The proposals would give investors this information by requiring companies to recognize regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities in the balance sheet and regulatory income or regulatory expense in the income statement. By accounting in this way for the effects of the differences in timing, a company would be reflecting the compensation to which it is entitled for goods or services supplied as part of its reported financial performance for the period in which those goods or services are supplied. This is precisely...
Can I just ask you to pause there? We've got a problem with the slides. I don't know if that you're running them from your end or whether Mariella is running in them, but they are coming through in a very almost fixated fashion to I think, all of us looking at them.
Okay, I see what the problem is. I think it's Mariella who is looking at the slides. Let me try to see if I can have them up.
Yes, it's me sharing the slides. Do you want to try yourself, Umar, then?
Yes, I'm trying.
That looks good.
Is it fine now?
We can certainly, I think that's certainly readable to me.
Okay, and we are on this slide.
Yeah, if you can get to that, are you able to get it so we could just see half of that full page, just the top half of that?
Umer, this is Tadeu. Would you like me to try to share?
Yes, if that's
okay. Let me try to do that.
If you use the share PDF button, Tadeu.
Yeah. I'm going there. Screen mode. Okay. For any reason, I'm getting the same problem, but I think that I still can get some better view. 1 second.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. Yeah. Thank you, everyone, for your patience. You. Let's carry on. Thank you.
Yes. In this slide, what we are trying to reflect is the basic principle of the model, that by accounting in this way for the effects of differences in timing, a company would actually reflect the compensation to which it is entitled to for goods or services supplied in the period as part of its financial performance for the period in which those goods or services are supplied. And the ED calls that compensation the total allowed compensation. Moving to next slide, slide 9. Continuing with the example that we discussed earlier, this slide illustrates the solution proposed by the ED. In year 1, the company would report regulatory income of CU20 to reflect the compensation for goods supplied in year 1 that is not included in the rates of that year, and report a regulatory asset of CU20 to reflect the right to add that amount in the rates for year 2. In year 2, the company would report regulatory expense of CU20 to reflect the fact that the rates charged in year 2, and hence the revenue for that year, include compensation for goods supplied in year one. The company would report zero regulatory asset to reflect the fact that it has already recovered the amount of CU20 in year two. The information about differences in timing in the financial statements would enable investors to understand better the relationship between a company's revenue and expenses. For example, that information would enable investors to understand how much of the increase or decrease in revenue from one period to another is because of the differences in timing we just discussed. Moving now to slide 10. This slide highlights the intended outcomes of the proposals. As we have been mentioning, requiring the provision of information about differences in timing in the financial statements is expected to improve investors' understanding of company's financial performance, financial position, and prospects of future cash flows. As we will see later on slide 25, companies would also be required to provide information about how risks and uncertainties affect the recovery of regulatory assets or regulatory liabilities. The proposals are also expected to improve the comparability of financial information because all companies affected by the proposals would use the same set of principles for reporting regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. Slides 12 to 16 get into the details of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. We do not aim to cover these slides in detail, but it would be worth emphasizing the key features of both a regulatory asset and regulatory liability. A regulatory asset arises because part of the compensation for goods or services supplied in the current period will be included in future rates and so will become revenue in future. In other words, it arises due to under-recovery of compensation for goods or services supplied in the current period that will be included in rates in a future period and therefore generate cash inflows in a future period. Slide 13 includes a few examples of under-recovery of compensation that creates regulatory assets. A regulatory liability arises because revenue already recognized includes part of the compensation for goods or services to be supplied in the future. In other words, it arises due to the over-recovery of compensation in the current period that will be deducted from rates in a future period and therefore generate lower cash inflows in a future period. Slide 15 includes a few examples of over-recovery of compensation that creates regulatory liabilities. Turning to slide 17 on total allowed compensation, we outline here the components that regulatory agreements include in what the ED refers to as the total allowed compensation. As we have discussed before, those components may be included in the rates charged to customers in the same period as the supply of goods or services, or in a different period. The ED provides guidance to help a company determine whether each component relates to goods or services supplied in the current period or whether it relates to goods or services supplied in a different period. Moving now to the measurement proposals on slide 19, the ED proposes to measure regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities using a cash flow-based measurement technique that includes an estimate of all future cash flows arising from a regulatory asset or regulatory liability and discount those estimated future cash flows to their present value. Now we move into the second half of our presentation where we focus on presentation, disclosure, and transition proposals. For each of these aspects, we have specific questions for you. We will ask the questions after presenting each section instead of waiting till the end of the presentation. Turning to slide.
I wonder whether we could just pause there because there's a question we've had in from Florian, which I think is useful to think about at this stage. And he asked, you know, conceptually, what are the differences here in timing versus normal pass-through contracts in other industries? So what makes regulatory income and expenses special? And I guess to my mind, it is that there is a difference in timing here, whereas normal pass-through contracts, those would all be recognized in the same period. But in the example that you gave us, and often we've talked about, you know, very simply about being able to be compensated for the cost of, let's say, storm damage in the first period that you incur as an entity, but you're not compensated for that until the second period in terms of when you're able to put that through as through your regulatory tariff. But it, do you want to just expand on that? What makes these differences? Why are these, how is this different from other pass-through contracts?
Yes, so the key difference with other pass-through contracts, in my view, is the other pass-through contracts may be giving a direct right to cash flows. So they are pretty much maybe financial assets or financial liabilities. Whereas in this case, these assets or liabilities are not a direct right to a cash flow. They will generate future cash flows. So in case of a regulatory asset, it will be a cash inflow. And in case of a regulatory liability, it will be a lower cash inflow. But it's not an automatic right to cash. The cash flows happen when the entity is able to increase or decrease the rates in the future that is charged to customers. So that is a key difference in my view between these type of assets and a pass-through contract, for example.
Thank you.
So with that, if I may continue with slide 21 for presentation proposals. So these proposals would not override the presentation requirements of current IFRS standards. Further, a key aspect I would like to highlight here is the presentation of all regulatory income minus all regulatory expense, which is the net movement between the opening and closing balances of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. That net amount would be presented as a separate line item immediately below revenue. The board considers this presentation to be simple and intuitive because regulatory income and regulatory expense are not themselves revenue, but they do reflect amounts that affect revenue in the past, current, or future periods. So first discussing regulatory income, it includes two types of items that affect revenue. One, additions of regulatory assets when the company supplied goods or services in the current period, but will only be able to include part of the compensation for those goods or services in future rates. And second, fulfillment of regulatory liabilities when the company supplied goods or services in the current period, but already charged for those goods or services and recognized revenue in an earlier period. And so it deducts that amount from the rates charged in the current period, and that deduction reduces revenue in the current period. Regulatory expense, again, reflects two types of items that affect revenue in the current period. First, recovery of regulatory assets because the company supplied goods or services in an earlier period and has now included part of the compensation for those goods or services in the rates charged in the current period. And second, additions of regulatory liabilities because the company charged customers in the current period and so recognized part of the compensation for goods or services it will supply in the future period as revenue in the current period. Because the company already charged that amount, it will have to deduct that amount from the rates it will charge in a future period, and that will reduce revenue in a future period. Moving now to slide 22. The proposed separate line item, regulatory income minus regulatory expense, would also include regulatory interest income and regulatory interest expense, which would reflect the compensation or charge to which a regulatory agreement entitles a company for the time lag until the company recovers a regulatory asset or fulfills a regulatory liability. When considering the interaction with the proposals in the primary financial statements exposure draft, the regulatory income minus regulatory expense line item would be within the operating category. The ED asks respondents questions on presentation. We have also included them on slide 23. We can pause here and open the floor for your feedback on these questions. And we are also happy to answer any questions that you may have on the proposals.
Great, thank you. So with that, let's see if there are any clarifications that CMAC members have around the proposals here, or any question or any responses to the questions that are posed on slide 23. Deirdre, thank you.
Sorry, there could be background noise. It's kind of lashing outside here. Lashing rain, sorry, for those of you who are not Irish, don't understand what lashing means. Just with regards to the presentation, I did a liaison with my colleague who'd be looking at the sector, and he was quite happy with the presentation that was suggested. He did suggest, though, that regards to the interest income and interest expense, that it's fine for the net figure to be on the face of the income statement, but that in the notes to the accounts, he'd like the detail to be broken down. I was just a more generic comment he had to make about the whole standard in its entirety. Was the fact that the regulatory agreements aren't always, you know, they're not set in stone at the beginning, so there'll always be some element of management discretion required when making assumptions, and again, it is just be the disclosure that's needed that we need to have that in the notes to the accounts if there is a management overlay being applied. It happens in life regularly, so it's not an issue as such, but again, it's just to have the disclosure in the notes so as we can understand how much is management's interpretation of what will happen.
Thanks, Deirdre. Philip, you had a question.
I do, Nick. I've got a comment as well, actually, if I can. Just I very much agree with what Deirdre said. I mean, I spoke to one of our utilities analysts yesterday, and they're very much of a view that they're already looking at what the regulatory assets and liabilities are anyway and making their assessment because they know that represents future income or future expense. I think there was a concern about, particularly on the asset side, about how recoverable that is, and examples where maybe the company has thought it has an asset which proved not to be recoverable. But I imagine that's all written into the guidance anyway. The question was, I'm sort of familiar. I worked in Canada many years ago and I audited a utility, and I'm sort of familiar with this from there. It seems very much like what they were doing at the time. Is it consistent with US GAAP, do we know?
Okay, so perhaps I can answer that question. So there are a number of differences in terms of how we approach this from an IFRS perspective. So in terms of US GAAP, that is primarily a cost deferral model. They, I think, do not require explicit discounting of future cash flows in their model, and they tend to override the presentation requirements of other standards. So essentially, they may override the presentation of expenses that are recoverable, or they may override the, they may defer revenue recognition. What we are proposing in our proposals is we do not override the presentation or the accounting of rights and obligations that is derived by other IFRS standards. And that is why we are proposing this regulatory income and expense as a separate line item on its own, immediately below revenue. And another difference is on the discounting. We require explicit estimates of future cash flows and then discounting them at a discount rate, which would in most cases be the regulatory interest rate. So that is another of the differences. So in terms of the outcomes, they may not be quite divergent, but in terms of the process and in terms of the approach that we have, it is quite different. And as I mentioned in the beginning, US GAAP is primarily a cost deferral model, whereas in the model that the board has proposed, there is an element of profit, which we call target profit, that would also be taken into account. So we do consider performance incentives, regulatory returns. And for example, if there is a VAC being provided on a regulatory capital base, so the accounting for that is also explicitly covered in our model. So it is not only about costs. And in terms of, I think, the earlier question that I think Dietri asked, just to quickly touch upon, so we will get into the disclosure requirements in the next section. But yes, the proposal do require explanation of risks and uncertainties that is associated with regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. And as I went through measurement, it is an estimate of future cash flows that would need to be updated at every reporting date. So an entity would need to consider and take into account any issues with recoverability of regulatory assets, for example.
Thanks. Bertrand.
Yes, my comments on this. First of all, I think this is an improvement. This exposure draft is an improvement to better understand and to better compare company and performance of companies. With regard to question one, I have not a strong view if it is to be explained or disclosed within the face of the primary financial statements or within the notes. Nevertheless, it should be at the upper end. Just it's not, I understand it's not exactly revenues, but it's just below revenues. So it must be at the upper of the P&L. With regard to the financial income and expense, my view is that such contracts are financial by nature. You know, the company is paid with a rate, with an interest on the what is invested either through OPEX or CAPEX. So having the interest income and expense within the operating side, as this is part of the business model of the company, for me, that makes sense. So this is my comments.
Thanks, Bertrand. And as you've seen, the requirement would be to present that line immediately beneath revenue, recognizing that it's not quite revenue, but it's very close to it. But also that, you know, yes, the standard here, the requirements here are incremental to existing IFRS standards rather than trying to amend those existing standards. So I think it's consistent with what you're suggesting.
Okay.
Great. Anthony.
Thanks, Nick. It's working fine for me. You can hear me?
We can, absolutely.
Okay, thanks. This issue is near and dear to my heart and to all the financial reporting issuers in Canada, especially. When we transitioned to IFRS in 2011, I was actually on the Accounting Standards Board, and we deferred application of the standard which related to rate regulated. We pleaded and prodded that you guys would, that someone on the ISB would figure out that we should have rate regulated assets. And eventually what happened is all our major utilities went to US GAAP. And today, it's a very, I think it's extremely sad, but basically we only have one. I believe they have about 12 different large public ones, and only one is on IFRS, and they provide reconciliation in their MD&A for the rate regulated assets, just so investors can understand. My question is, what took so long to figure out that these were assets and liabilities? And now that we're on that page, why make it difficult and start discounting when it's a regulatory issue? And now you're going to create more differences to US GAAP. And not that we have to follow US GAAP because they're perfect, but they've been doing this for a long time. And why do we have to create differences? It just causes no end of confusion, especially on this side of the Atlantic, maybe not on that side, but on this side of the Atlantic, it causes tremendous confusion. And what basically has happened, you know, the horse has already left the barn. We've already gone, all of the companies have gone to US GAAP. So that's my two questions. Why make it different, and what took so long? Thanks.
Thank you very much. I can answer these questions. It took long to figure it out that those balances were assets and liabilities were fulfilling the definitions of the conceptual framework, because the conceptual framework itself was a project that was live and was still being developed when we were discussing the same items. So the conceptual framework was published in March 2018, And that publication actually triggered that we made a lot of progress in this project during 2018 and 2019. So to your first question, we needed a stable and solid foundation, and that was a conceptual framework, and the conceptual framework did not finish until 2018. The second part of your question about discounting, making it difficult, we have heard this from different stakeholders, and the proposals required to discount the estimates of future cash flows using the regulatory interest rate that is being provided by the regulatory agreement. And that means that basically when you include in your future cash flows the interest component using that regulatory interest rate, and then you discount those cash flows using the same discount rate, you end up basically going back to the present value being the nominal of the difference in timing initially. So we don't think necessarily that discounting proposals would actually be very burdensome or costly, because we are saying that they should be discounting those future cash flows using the same regulatory interest rate. The board considered whether to incorporate an expedient, a practical expedient, and by saying, well, if the time value of money basically or is not relevant, then entities would not necessarily need then to discount. But having that additional requirement would complicate the proposals, would make the model more complex, and also we would then need to, it would make entities have an additional judgment in the process. And also, regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities, it takes a time until they get into the final rate. So how much time as an expedient should the board propose? 12 months might not be enough. That might be then 24 months. And in 24 months, the time value of money and uncertainties could be material. So that's why that practical expedient was discarded. And the proposal then proposed to require this estimate of future cash flows discounting using the regulatory interest rate.
Did the board consider that that there'd be differences to U.S. GAAP, and what did they think about that?
Well, the proposals were developed considering what the users needed in measurement and what the nature of these items were. So, for example, when coming up with a cash flow based measurement technique, the board analyzed what is the nature of those cash flows, that those cash flows are stable, predictable. They might change, but are fairly predictable. And what users need is information about those cash flows. And that's why the discount rate used at initial recognition was not proposed to be updated every time there were movements in market interest rates. So when putting together the proposals, the board considered what would end up being more useful information for users, and not necessarily criteria of being closer or farther away from US GAAP. So that was not necessarily a consideration in the development of the proposals. Of course, when we have finalized the proposals, we compare how far away we are. And as Umer said, yes, the articulation of the principles and the requirements are different. We do have a principle in these proposals, which is to reflect in the financial performance of an entity the compensation that an entity is entitled for the goods or services it supplied. So we do have this principle. This principle triggers the recognition of regulatory assets, regulatory liabilities. But apart from this big difference in the articulation of the requirements, we don't think necessarily that the outcomes will be that different from US GAAP.
Yeah. They may not be, but then even just a small subtlety is where you know, you can get confused as an investor. That's all. All right, thanks.
Marianne. Thanks, Anthony. Oliver?
Hi, thanks. The context being someone that hasn't spent very much time at all looking at utilities in great detail, but so that's the context. But the question would be what these, I don't think these are financing assets or liabilities, and that's pretty clear, but maybe I'm wrong. But then what are they? Are they clearly operating assets and liabilities, or are they simply regulatory assets and liabilities? And you know, I guess I'm not maybe used to thinking in those terms, maybe having not looked at utilities too much, but that was the question. And then I guess just to answer maybe the first question of those two, to me, again, completely stepping back from being in the details of utilities analysis, it would make more sense to, wouldn't it? It would seem to make more sense to put it in the notes. I mean, I'm sure there are regulatory filings and, you know, for the regulatory assets where you can find this information. But if you put it in, you know, obviously by putting it onto the P&L, as a generalist looking at that, that would certainly cause, well, it would cause me to ask questions, but maybe that's a good thing. I wonder why actually put it onto the, you know, the primary statements, why not put it into the notes?
I think I can take this. So to answer your second question first, so the primary reason for having this into the primary financial statements is because for the moment, what users get is the IFRS 15 revenue number in the face of the profit or loss. But for entities that are subject to regulatory agreements, which create regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities, the profit or loss statement for the moment does not reflect the full compensation that these companies are entitled to in the same period. So taking you to the simple example that we had discussed, and this is on slide 7, which introduces the problem. So what happens is you just get revenue of 100 in year one, and your compensation for that year that the regulatory agreement entitles the company is 120. As a result, you see a loss currently of 20, but that does not reflect the true economics of the regulatory agreement because all what the P&L is showing now is the revenue from contracts with customers. It is not showing the effects of the regulatory agreement on the prices that the company is able to charge customers. In year two, when the regulatory agreement allows the company to include those amounts in the rates, you have a jump in revenue of 120, but you don't have a jump in the expenses because the company only incurred 100, and then you have a profit of 20. So in a way, like this difference in timing does not give a true picture of the compensation being reflected in the appropriate period. And that is the primary reason to have these amounts on the face of the P&L, because right now, as I said, the profit or loss only reflects IFRS 15. It does not reflect the economic phenomena from this regulatory agreement.
So thank you. I understand that. So but equally, if there was a liquidation event or something, this is not a contractual, you know, the company doesn't have the right to get that money back unless it provides future service to its customers. Is that correct? It's not like a contract or something. I think someone mentioned that earlier. So that's really was the basis from where my question was coming from. And then I guess that leads to, is this a financial asset? So I don't think it is. Is it clearly not breaking up?
Yes, so it is not a financial asset because it is not a right, a contractual right to a cash flow. It is a right to increase the rate in the future. And that increase would then generate these cash flows. And there's an agreement between the company and the regulator, or it's a separate agreement from customer contracts.
But I mean, any company a company that's not in a regulated environment can decide to put their prices up next year.
Yes, and that type of a right is not captured.
Reflect income from that, really.
Yeah, but that general right to increase or an economic incentive to decrease prices is not captured by the model. So that does not give rise to a regulatory asset or regulatory liability. So the regulatory asset is a right to increase the rate by a fixed amount, and only as a result of goods or services supplied in the past. It is not a right to increase or decrease any amount. It is a specific fixed amount.
Okay, so I guess my last point, this would be that then there's an implicit assumption that the business is going to be providing that service next year, which, you know, and under most circumstances, you know, would happen in the utility. But
yeah.
just
yeah yeah
okay Just so I've got that right. So we're implicitly assuming the business is around to provide that service next year.
Yes, and essentially the regulatory agreement gives the company the right to recover those cash flows in the future. And to your first point, primarily these would be operating, because the companies that are involved in these sort of agreements, they have utility business as their core operations. So that line item would be falling into the operating category. Thank you.
Thanks. Matthias. Hi, we're not hearing you, Matthias.
Good. Now? Does it work?
Yep.
Yeah. Perfect. Okay. Thanks, Nick. Sorry. Oliver's question was also more or less mine. So the question was, how is a regulatory asset defined? What gives rise to a regulatory asset? So this already had just one comment. But also others have said before. This looks good. This proposition increases visibility, but I think much depends really on the quality of how companies build these regulatory assets or liabilities, about the degree of discretion, of management discretion. Because for regulated activities, often because of the high visibility that we have in general, often smaller changes to the performance have a very strong price effect. And so I cannot really fully understand now at the moment how big the possibilities are for companies here to build assets a bit higher or lower, or liabilities a bit higher or lower. But this will be the crucial point, the quality of how these assets and liabilities are built. Yeah, thanks.
Thanks, Matthias. But Bertrand, you had an additional comment.
Yes, just one comment to be more clear about what I said is that should this kind of revenue included as a separate line or included in a line that is other revenue like, I have not a strong view, but nevertheless, it should be within the numbers, within the primary financial statements at a level around the revenue according to IFRS 15. This is my view. It should be at the upper at the eight of the PFS. In my view, it should not be deducted from the operating cost. You should keep the operating cost as it is, because this is the cost that the company has endured. And so these are the costs. The costs are there. But anyway, the revenue should be at the upper end of the just below a separate line. I don't know. But at least within a line below the revenue as according to IFRS 15. So to be clear, and then the disclosure is key to explain what is it and what it comes. If it is not a separate line, what the other revenue are and what is it including in this, and I expect what about this expectation of revenue according to the regulatory agreement. Do I am clear about this?
Thanks, Bertrand. Very clear. And I think what you suggest is completely aligned with the board's proposal to have a separate line immediately beneath revenue. So with transparency and not bundling it up with anything else.
Yes, to a cognizant of time.
Yeah, cognizant of time. But Oliver, you wanted one further comment.
Thank you. So it's a question, and I'll just put the context of it. But the question is, we're assuming then that also the volume is going to be the same the following year as it was in this year, in the example you're giving. And so that's the question. The context would be, you know, if you take about, and this is way beyond my wheelhouse, but I'll try. If you take, you know, the energy system, there's a lot of change going on there, and, you know, with distributed energy systems and, you know, individuals creating energy in their own home. So, you know, if the answer to the first question is yes, we assume the volume will be the same, is that, you know, just to be clear on that, you know, is that something to consider? If that is, you know, going forward, we can rely on that as much as we could do in the past, perhaps. I'm obviously specifically talking about energy systems here. That
was it. Yes, so I think the proposals would factor that into estimates of future cash flows, and I think like the company would need to make estimates of the volume that it would be seeing in terms of the rates that it will be able to charge customers in the future. But obviously, from the perspective of the regulatory agreement, it is not only safeguarding the interest of customers in providing a essential public service, but it is also looking at the financial viability of the company. So if the company is not able to recover those amounts in a short period of time, then what we understand is the regulatory agreements compensate the company for the time lag through regulatory interest. So in a way, the company, the regulatory agreement would ensure the company gets the amount that it's due to recover. And if the company has any uncertainty surrounding that, then that would be factored into the measurement of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities.
Thanks. Let's move on to the next section. We've got about 10 to 15 minutes left. So.
Yeah, okay. So moving now to the disclosure proposals and turning to slide 24. The overall disclosure objective proposed by the board focuses on providing useful information about the effects of differences in timing on companies' financial performance and financial position. A company would be required to disclose in the notes information about regulatory income and regulatory expense, which, together with the information provided by applying other IFRS standards, would enable investors to understand the relationship between companies' revenue and expenses as completely as they can when there are no differences in timing. So when all of the compensation for goods or services supplied in a period is included in the rates in that same period. A company would also be required to disclose information to enable investors to understand the company's regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. And that understanding would provide investors with insights into how regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities affect the company's future cash flows. Moving now to the proposed disclosure requirements on slide 25. A company would be required to disclose a breakdown of that separate line item of regulatory income minus regulatory expense. I will talk about that breakdown in the next slide. A company would also be required to disclose a maturity analysis of the regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities that are outstanding at the year end. And as I mentioned in one of my responses earlier, the company would disclose an explanation of risks and uncertainties and how they affect the recovery or fulfillment of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. The ED also proposes that a company disclose information about the discount rates used in measuring regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. The company would also be required to disclose a reconciliation from the opening to the closing balance of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. Turning to slide 26 on the specific disclosure proposal for the breakdown of regulatory income minus regulatory expense, the board proposes this requirement to enable investors to understand the components and causes of regulatory income or regulatory expense. Going back to the very simple example that we discussed previously, the regulatory income of CU20 in year one consists fully of additions of regulatory asset. The regulatory expense of CU20 in year two consists fully of the recovery of the regulatory asset in year two. In other situations, some of the other components and causes of regulatory income or regulatory expense would include additions or fulfillment of regulatory liabilities, regulatory interest income, regulatory interest expense that we ignored in the simple example that we discussed. Other items affecting measurement of regulatory assets or regulatory liabilities, such as estimates of changes in future cash flows. The ED asks respondents questions on disclosures. We have also included them on slide 27. We can pause here and open the floor now for your feedback.
Thanks. So we've touched upon the importance around disclosures already. Any other further observations, comments, thoughts from members around the disclosure part of the proposals? Florin, over to you.
Yeah, so I mean, as some of my colleagues mentioned, utilities is a very special area. So I actually also talked to my specialists on this. And their comment on the disclosure was what they would be most interested in is the time period, the maturity disclosure. So how far out do these things stretch? They find some of the other stuff, particularly on the discount rates and so forth, probably to be a little bit of an overkill, simply because trying to sort of figure out how, what the sensitivities, you know, in the assumptions of future regulatory assets onto those discount rates would is pretty much impossible. So, you know, they wouldn't know what really to do with these disclosures. So they said what is really important is the maturity profile so that they can sort of put that into the model and think about it a little bit more. Discount rate they didn't feel a lot about, and if there's qualitative around risks and uncertainty, that'd be great. But, you know, that unfortunately oftentimes is not really helpful beyond sort of boilerplate statements. Thanks.
Thanks, Florian. Ostrom?
Yes, a comment about the risk. My question is not only about disclosure, but about the measurement also. Disclosure is key, as I understand, about the risk. But how does the, maybe the question was already answered in parts, but how does the measurement take into account the potential effect of risk with regard to future cash flow? I mean that there is a regulatory agreement, but maybe it will not be as the company may expect, even with the agreement. How does it translate into the future revenue and future cash flow? Because having the future cash flow at the top within the P&L means that you should rely and you expect very strongly to rely on this future cash flow, future and future revenue. So this is my question to and we have to take care about this.
I think like we touched upon this earlier as well. So in terms of estimates of future cash flows, the company would be making an estimate of its best prediction as to how much cash flows it could recover. But in terms of the overarching arrangement, that regulatory agreement, and whether it ensures that the company is able to secure those cash flows, I think it is critical to understand that the regulatory agreement is trying to protect customers, but it is also trying to ensure the financial viability of the company. So if the company is not able to recover those cash flows, or if the company is not able to rely on the regulatory agreement, then the whole model comes into question. The company may not if the regulatory agreement is not enforceable, if the regulatory agreement is not giving the security to the company to be able to recover those cash flows, then the regulatory agreement may not fall into the scope of the ED in the first place, because one of the key requirements of the regulatory agreements that is captured by the proposals is that it needs to be enforceable. It needs to give sort of a like security to the company. It needs to be sort of like there needs to be an element of reliability. But as regards the measurement specifically of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities, the estimates of future cash flows need to take into account any uncertainty.
Thanks. Do you mean that
interest rate could be adjusted to take into account this uncertainty, or is it so provisioned? How is it?
Yes, so the measurement proposals require estimates of future cash flows and then discounting those cash flows using the regulatory interest rate. If there is any uncertainty regarding the estimates of future cash flows because of, for example, lack of volume, if there's demand risk or if there's credit risk, then those estimates of cash flows need to be adjusted, and then they need to be discounted at the regulatory interest rate.
Sorry to go on. So you mean that the line will include the risk associated to the ability to recover this cash flow beyond the interest rate, but the ability for the company to recover the cash flow, the expected cash flow. Because if there is a risk that the cash flow is not there, do we have this on the revenue line?
So the risk is captured as No, it's not the interest rate. It's these are the expected cash flows, and if there's a, and that would reflect, you know, effectively a best estimate of weighted average. You would capture your risk within that, within the cash flows, your adjustments to the cash flows, rather than in the interest rate, which is going to be the regulatory interest rate in all circumstances.
Because it is very important to have the right figure, you know, to have some confidence within the figure, because this is not cash flow, current cash flow, but future cash flow.
Absolutely. Yes. Is that clear? Okay, great.
Yes, it's clear for me. Thank you.
Good, good. Excellent. Deirdre.
Sorry, I actually just have a question rather than an explicit comment. And again, this was raised when we were looking at it internally. And it's questions to whether or not construction companies that might be building the relevant facilities would they get caught under this standard? And if so, they obviously, there'd be capex involved when they're building those facilities, etc. So maybe incremental disclosure on the cash flow. But it's a question, as you can tell. I don't know what the answer is. Is the expectation that that type of regulated build would be caught in this standard?
To answer that, so it would pretty much depend on the actual facts and circumstances of the arrangement. But if we take a plain vanilla fact pattern, then if that company has to provide supply of water or electricity to customers, and in the process it needs to construct a power plant or a utility plant, and the regulatory agreement allows the entity to pass those costs to customers ultimately, and the regulatory agreement meets all the features, that is, it is enforceable and it sets the rate in a way that causes differences in timing and so on. So then it could potentially be in the scope of the proposals, yes. But if the construction company is sort of a developer and it is a contractual agreement between the developer and some other service provider, so there is no customers involved who are receiving those goods or services in a general sense, then it may not be. But again, like it would depend on the specific facts and circumstances.
So just to clarify, if the facts and circumstances imply this standard is going to apply, we could then expect that there would be disclosure with regards to the implications for the regulatory, the build of that regulatory asset in terms of cash flow, etc., that all of that incremental disclosure would be available as well?
Yes, that is right, as long as there are differences in timing. So if you're specifically referring to the build of the asset, then yeah. I would presume that that build would be captured as a property, plant, and equipment under IES 16. Mm-hmm. If in case the company then starts providing services to customers and in one period it is not able to charge all the compensation that the regulatory agreement entitles it to charge in that period, as a result there are differences in timing, then you will get all the associated disclosures regarding regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. Because that built on day one, that would be captured by IES 16 property, plant, and equipment, not by these proposals. I'm not sure if I answered that.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, is it useful for, again, sorry, this is not my area of expertise at all, so.
I think maybe there's a general tendency of maybe an expectation that the disclosures or the proposals would require information about the general effects of rate regulation in terms of that example, but the proposals do not require such information. The proposals are very targeted to providing information about regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities that arise because of differences in timing.
Okay. I suppose it would be helpful if there was a requirement for companies to provide that little bit of incremental disclosure. I suppose it would be to their own benefit to provide that if they're building something that's going to be part of this regulatory framework, if you want to call it that. I hope I'm making sense.
Okay. I think one of the reasons that the board did not go in that direction was because that sort of information could be gathered from other sources, such as MD&A and so on, rather than in the financial statements itself. That was one of the considerations that board had. But thank you for your comments.
Rosemary, can I go to you?
Thanks. I'm just following up on Bertram's comment. And so he was talking about the risk of cash flows and revenue. And I think it goes back to Oliver's comment, which I thought was a good point, where he's saying, Oliver was saying, there's a change in the source or the demand for electricity, for example, right? Because there's a movement to, let's say, clean tech. Then the assumptions you've made on that asset really don't stand. And I'm just wondering if that's been taken into consideration or said differently. In that case, you'd be overstating your revenue, your cash flows. But perhaps that's taken into account in your interest income, because that's a change in your asset and your liability. But anyway, I just wanted to maybe get some more clarification on that, because you could have a situation where you set something up on day one. Makes sense. It's the timing difference, the setup, I get all that. But if there's a change in demand, that revenue you've booked could be overstated.
Okay, so first to answer that point about revenue, the revenue line is accounted for by IFRS 15, so we are not touching that at all. What we are trying to add onto the face of the P&L is regulatory income, regulatory expense that will affect revenue in a future period, or it may affect in the current period. Now, in terms of your specific concern about that regulatory asset or income being overstated. So on day one, the measurement proposals require an entity to make an estimate of the future cash flows, and then those future cash flows include any compensation for the time lag, so regulatory interest cash flows as well, which the regulatory agreement provides the company, and then discount those cash flows using the regulatory interest rate. Now, as time progresses and the company has another understanding of the cash flows because of the volume, if there is going to be any shortfall, or if there are any further risks that those amounts may not be fully recoverable, then the company is required to update its estimates of future cash flows at every reporting date, and then use those updated estimates of future cash flows and discount it back using the regulatory interest rate, which the proposals require to keep unchanged. So what we understand is that would take care of any potential impairment in those assets and liabilities. In addition, the disclosures are required to provide information about risks and uncertainties that are associated with these balances, and that would also be helping or providing information to users about the health of these balances in a way. So if there are any other more specific measures or any other specific proposals that you think would be helpful in ensuring the health of these assets and liabilities, we would be happy to hear about those as well.
Thanks. So we're fast running out of time. In fact, we've gone over time. So if we could make, Jeremy, perhaps if this could be the last comment on this section, then we have one final area of questioning that we'd like to quickly flag. But Jeremy, over to you.
Well, thank you. Just quickly, a clarification as a non-utility person. Is the goal really to provide this extra line under revenue so that I can consider IFRS 15 revenue plus this line as the kind of equivalent revenue for non-regulated utilities, the amount they could have earned if they were able to, in the normal market, charge their customers what they could do? So that's the first question in terms of how I can interpret it from a generalist perspective. And just the second question on the last point that was mentioned, when you review the estimates every year, you said it wasn't an impairment, but what happens to the, when you write down the asset or write up the asset, what's the other side of the double entry?
Okay, so to your second question. What happens is when an entity updates the estimates of future cash flows, there may be a change in the carrying amount of the regulatory asset on balance sheet, and that change would be reflected in the same line item of regulatory income or regulatory expense. So we are not requiring a separate line item for that. But nevertheless, the disclosure requirement that is proposed gives a detailed breakdown of the causes, and that will have a separate disclosure of the changes in the carrying amount resulting from changes in estimates of future cash flows. So you will have that detail in the notes to some extent. And then to your first point about the subtotal, the board does not propose requiring a subtotal, but for comparison purposes, that subtotal represents the total compensation that the company is entitled to for that period. So you have, in the example that we discussed, in year one, we have a total compensation of 120, but the company was only able to include in the rates 100. So the regulatory income amount actually tops up or adds on to that revenue number of 100 and gives you a subtotal of 120. So you can perhaps look at that subtotal as the total compensation that the regulatory agreement entitles the company for year one. Similarly, in year two, if you add 120 and regulatory expense of 20, you will get 100. That reflects the compensation of 100 that the regulatory agreement entitles the company for year two.
If I may add something very quick here, I think your initial consideration goes in the right direction. So I'm not sure who was the gentleman expressing this view about whether he could consider the revenue and the regulatory income, regulatory expense total to indicate the compensation that the entity is entitled to for the services supplied in that year. Yes, that's a good initial step. However, one would need to consider whether revenue includes revenue from regulated and non-regulated activities, and also whether revenue includes not only revenue from contracts with customers, but also other sources of revenue. And this is when then that subtotal might not make sense. So we need to be careful and see whether that revenue amount, it's only about rate-regulated entities. And if so, then yes, you could have a very good understanding of what is the compensation that the entity earned during that year for the services supplied in that year by considering the revenue line and the regulatory income minus regulatory expense line. But if revenue includes different items there, then you would not have that indication.
And just to great, summarize thanks. That. Just to summarize
we're
that.
Really, we're really okay. out okay. of time. So okay. do you want so, to quickly deal with transition?
Yes. So, in slide 29 and 30, we just summarized the likely effects. And then if we move to slide 31, this slide illustrates what investors will see in the financial statements when the proposed standard is first applied. A company would apply the proposals retrospectively on transition to the proposed standard, which means that all comparative information presented in the first financial statements prepared applying the proposals would have to be restated. That approach would make data comparable across time periods and across companies. The ED asked respondents questions on transition. We have included them on slide 32. We can pause here and take your feedback.
Thanks. So full retrospective approach is what the board is proposing. Just whether there are any views out there amongst members on these proposed transition arrangements. We will take, unless we hear from you, we will take that as agreement.
Okay, so that means I can move to wrap up my session then?
Yeah, please.
Okay, so just wrapping up with the next steps on slide 34. So as you know, the board issued the ED in January, and with the 150-day comment period, the deadline for sending in your comments is 30 June. We would very much welcome responses from you all, and we thank you for all the feedback you have provided today. Please also feel free to reach out to your colleagues, as some of you have already pointed out, who may be following companies that could be impacted by these proposals, and we will be happy to get in touch with them. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mary. There, thanks, Emma. Very, very helpful. And I know it's a new topic to a number of members, and I think we're all trying to get our heads around the issue. I guess for me, just the last word is that in some respects we have a volatility within existing reporting, which solely reflects the accounting. And what this seeks to do is better reflect the underlying economics rather than any volatility that's simply coming from the accounting. So the board certainly thinks this is a significant improvement for those rate regulated businesses. But again, very much welcome your feedback. And if you're able to provide those introductions to your specialists in this area, that would be really appreciated. So thank you.